Okay. Well, hello everyone. It's July 6th, 2020. A lot of interesting things to do. Unlike last week, I'm going to respond to some questions and comments. Actually, first, I forgot to mention when we spoke about the dispute in Yemen, I have a video. Here it is. You can see it. Mori or Yosef Kafach used to be on YouTube. They divided it into like six parts, but they must have taken it off. It's very interesting. It's by his granddaughter, who's a film student, and it's a whole story of his life and the great dispute in Yemen. Okay, a couple things. I went on some tangents. I just want to give you the sources because people asked. I mentioned women not doing kriya for Avelos in Iraq. By the way, Morocco also they didn't in many places, but that you can look at the Ben Ish Chai in his responsa. It's Rav Pealim, volume 3, Yoredeya 27, and he says here, Po ha'ir Baghdad ein nogim hanashim lasot kriya ba'anashim klal, and he doesn't even justify it or explain it. Chacham Avadi Yosef says that this is nonsense. We can't accept what the Ben Ish Chai says, but the Ben Ish Chai is testifying to the practice throughout all of Baghdad, not just Baghdad, all of Iraq, and Mordechai Eliyahu defended this. I quoted, just to give you the pages again, about we spoke about cut fruit. And so here, this is the book I was referring to, The Laws of Kashrus, the Art Scroll book. You can look on page 311. And obviously, some people had an issue with it because they went to Rav Elyashiv. And he says you can purchase cut watermelon in a fruit store, since presumably they keep separate knives to cut the melons. And in the note here, they mention it. They asked Rav Elyashiv, and because what? Maybe they'll use it to cut tarfus. And Rav Elyashiv said, you don't need to be concerned about that. And with kashrut, it's always hard because I don't know. Maybe some part of the country they tell them that you shouldn't do that. But I've never heard it or seen it. But other times things are different. I mean, in this country, in America, we're told that you need to have hashgachas in every product, and it's already become part of the lingo. If something doesn't have hashgacha, you'll say, well, it's not kosher. It's not kosher. When really, properly, the language is we don't know if it's kosher. And this very concept that we're brought up on, that you cannot buy a product unless it has hashgacha. When we go to the supermarket, that's what we look for. I mean, it would be unimaginable to someone in Europe because they don't have shashkachas and products in the store, other than, let's say, if you go into a special little kosher store. So, I mean, kashrus is a thing that it really depends a lot where you are. If you go, I'll give you another example. If you go to Europe, for instance, and you have one of the caterers there, and I can testify to Gibraltar, I can testify to Madrid, and I can testify to Morocco, and this is the case, I believe, everywhere. I shouldn't say England, but other way places, all the other places I know of in Europe. If let's say you have an affair at a hotel, so they kosher the kitchen and everything, they will use regular coffee mugs for the coffee. They won't bring their own. So I think most people, when they stay at a hotel, they will also use the regular coffee mugs. Maybe some won't, and use a styrofoam. But I am certain that no hashgacha organization in America would ever use the coffee mugs of the hotel. They would supply their own. And so what would be the problem with using it? Well, milk, I guess. But today all the milk is kosher, but they wash it together with the non-kosher stuff. Okay, so you have to take it up with the rabbis in all those countries. The Chacham Avad Yosef has tshuva. He says it's not a problem. They're not concerned about it. This is the same issue with Starbucks. Remember, a couple of years ago, Starbucks came out saying that you shouldn't drink the coffee in places if they have other things. And my sense is I don't drink coffee, so all these things are not relevant to me, because they were concerned that they'd wash the coffee thing. And my sense is that that was pretty much ignored. You can see there's a lot of shiurim online. I think Rabbi Ari Leibowitz has one and others, where people explain why you don't need to be concerned, even if they would wash it together with the other stuff. And I know for a fact that among the Hasidim, they drink the Starbucks coffee still. But that's the same issue. Well, are you worried about it? Of course, if they always use detergent, it's no same time with gum. Certainly don't need to be concerned that maybe once someone put some non-kosher soup in a coffee mug. Again, so these are You know what? You ask your own rabbi. I'm just telling you that in Europe, they use the same coffee mugs because they hold it's not an issue. And that's so you see, if you're used to one thing, you'll go there and you'll find it perhaps a little strange. Incidentally, if you go on the CRC website, I haven't done it recently, it's probably still there. When they discuss the coffee thing, even they are not 100% strict on certain things. They have certain categories where they say, if you're traveling, you could be lenient. And that goes back to what we mentioned, though, to be Huda, that already there's leniencies when you travel. But the coffee drinkers, you can tell me, you can send in the chat, has this had any effect at all in your community when the Star K? It was a CRC, not the Star K, I believe. So no, it was a Star K that has on their website about traveling. It was a CRC, I believe. No, it was a Star K, I think, who came out against the Starbucks. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't pay attention. As I said, I don't drink the coffee, but I don't know. Okay, a couple other things. I mentioned this this incident, was it last class or the class before, I believe, of holding up a knife, someone from the Peleg, the threat to the Rosh Hashiva. So someone asked, we've done a lot of courses in Jewish history, have we had violence in yeshivas? Maybe it's in the news because of all the violence we have in this country right now. It's interesting, I think, because we have violence today. I mean, I've showed in the past, I showed videos of throwing chairs and crazy stuff going on in Bnei Brak and Ponevezh. There was even a stabbing there. But I have to say that in past years, even in the heights of the dispute between the in the yeshiva world, we basically I am not aware of any examples of any real violence, stabbings, killings, anything like that. We have some violence Hasidim the Misnagdim, and we have some violence Orthodox Maskilim, Reform, but no, nothing like I mentioned in a blog post in Ponevezh and. In the 40s, someone joined the Irgun, and some people then in the yeshiva attacked him. They covered his face with a blanket, and they beat him. But basically, we have very, very little in the way of violence. It's sort of like a modern thing. But since I was asked, I will tell you something, which if you haven't heard of, it'll probably blow you away. And I'm not making it up. Here it is. It's my Talmud Yerushalmi. If you open up the Yerushalmi in Shabbos, Perek Aleph, Halacha Dalet, it talks about, in fact, the Mishnah we're going to speak about in 1 minute when they made the decrees against Pasakum, etc. It talks about, and this is page Tess Amud Aleph, if you have the standard edition, it talks about how between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and it talks about the feud they had here. And I'll read you the exact lashon here. It says that Beis Shammai was together at Beis Shammai, Beis Shammai. The Yerushalmi tells us that there was a fight that took place between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and Beis Shammai actually, some of them killed Beis Hillel, people in Beis Hillel. That's how violent it got. If you look in the Karban Eda on the spot, he's the standard commentary. He's the teacher of Mendelssohn, incidentally, the Karban Eda. He says he can't believe it. He says, Chas v'shalom, that they would do this. He sees it as an exaggeration. But if you look at many other commentaries, they take it as literal. So we do have an example of where Torah scholars can get so excited that they can be led to do terrible things. Poorly of the people who committed the murders, but maybe this is an example of people who were Torah scholars but didn't have any real ethics. They were just they could learn a lot, but because anyone who would pick up a knife and stab another person, obviously we have a problem. Two other things, just to give you the source, I mentioned last class about Rav Schechter, and I just give you the exact thing about what he said to do for a chola who's by himself or herself. If you look on the YU website, and they sent out, he published about 25 different responsa before Pesach. And let me just read you what he says. If a person were to leave the telephone on before Yom Tov and conduct a Pesach Seder from their home so that others can follow along, like Balei Tshuva who may not know how to run a Seder. So in other words, we're leaving our phones, I'm speaking into the phone, and the other person is listening. There may be reason to be lenient under great and pressing circumstances. So Rav Schechter allows a Seder with a telephone for such a person. He even includes a Baal Tshuva, who's by himself and doesn't know how to run the Seder. But then he says, however, to leave a computer screen on and to have people watch it connect over the internet is a greater concern of violating Shabbos and Yom Tov, since it creates images and pictures when the people move, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but still, this what he said was quite radical. He's not doing the Zoom, but I guarantee you, had those Moroccan rabbis came out and said do a telephone thing, they would have been attacked by the Haredi in the same way that they were attacked for the Zoom. Because most people are not thinking like Rav Schechter halachically, well, a telephone is one thing, but a computer, you have screens and all that. They're just saying it's electricity. I guarantee you, everyone who said the Zoom is crazy, it's because they said it's electricity. Rav Schechter is saying that this could possibly be permitted, that the computer is not. So I find it interesting. And now let me show you something. You think this is just like a modern Orthodox or a centrist post sake? I want to show you something. You listen for 1 minute. I'm going to show you something on the screen. They call him the senior post sake of Lakewood. I don't know if everyone agrees he's the senior, but he's certainly a senior post sake. And he's speaking about, he's speaking about, I have to share it again. I have to, so you can listen. He's speaking about people with addictions, alcohol and other things. And look, and he's very sensible. I think all sensible person would say it, but if this was someone else, I think they think you're crazy. But listen carefully to what he says. Senior post-take in Lakewood.
I've paskened this in the past, Lamaisa, and I want to make it clear now that anybody in recovery, anybody doing the step work and has a chashash that he needs help, he has to make sure that his recovery is rock solid. He has a chashash that he has to call a meeting, call into a Zoom meeting, attend the meeting, call up a sponsor, whatever. Shouldn't make any chashoshes, no, shouldn't make any chashboinus. He has to make sure not to start on that slippery slope. Forget about Shabbos, forget about Yom Tov, forget about Yom Kippur. You have to make that call, you have to log on, you have to attend. You must avoid that slippery slope. David should bench us all, have rachmanis on all of his Yiddish kinder.
So here, I mean, you find this leading postik in Lakewood saying that if you're in some sort of AA or something like that, you get on the phone. You do what you have to do. Very, very interesting. And finally, the kashrus of the fish in South Africa, it's the king clip. That's the one. I found it out. Last thing I want to say is we ended with Rav Schechter and Nachum, if you're on with me, yes, I get it. There's still some Sephardic socket, Piskei Halacha, which even the yeshiva world they listen to. But we dealt with Pasakum, Paspalter, actually. And I thought, so a number of people emailed me things about this. Again, to remind you what was said, that non-Jewish bread we're not supposed to eat, but not allowed to, but... Well, generally not, but paspalter, if it's from a bakery, then we're allowed to, according to the Ramah. Generally, you're allowed to, according to the Ramah. Others are more machmir. They say unless it's a, it has to be more expensive, the kosher bread, etc. But the Ramah is matur. So when I asked Rav Schechter, going in Europe, eating bread, he said that only a shas adchak. But we're generally, I said, I found it interesting, because we generally don't assume only in a shas adchak. And then we raise the issue of the different hashkachas on breads, Arnold's bread, etc. So one of you sent me, thank you very much, Hyman, Rabbi Ganak has an article in the first issue of Masora where he, you can see he compares paspalter also to bishulakum. Rav Moshe held there's no bishulakum in factories. Because there's no connect, even though Rabbi Ganak says the OU doesn't hold this. But because it makes so much sense where Moshe says. The whole idea of Bishulakum is that we'll have create relationships that will lead to intermarriage. If a factory in China, what is that? We're not, there's no connection. So you can make a distinction perhaps between the local bakery and a commercially produced products. Perhaps that's the difference. Although someone else sent me that apparently in Israel they don't the Rabbanut does not accept any OU breads or anything. I don't know. Generally, we assume that Passpalter is bakery bread, as well as bread you buy in the store, Arnold's bread. I don't want to spend any more time on that because we have a lot of interesting things to do. So now we are picking up in the Sefer Siman Lamed Zion. Okay, this requires a little bit of background here. The question, incidentally, we are going to be hearing from the answer from the great Gaon Rav Sholem Misas. We've mentioned a few times already, the chief rabbi of Morocco and then chief rabbi of Jerusalem for many years. So see at the bottom here, the article about him, he's called Ribi Sholem Misas, because that's the old way in the Sephardic world of referring to rabbi is Ribi. If you look in, as I recall, the Budapest, the Kaufman manuscript of the Mishnah, the oldest punctuated Mishnah, they also have Ribi. That seems to be the original way to say rabbi as Ribi. The question is, can you assist Christians in building their churches? So what's this all about? Well, and we'll see how this also plays out into conservative reform synagogues as well. The question, and he actually printed my letter to him, my question was, you might recall in the 90s, there was all these discussions about the news about churches being burnt down in the South. Firstly, they said it was black churches. Turned out there's a lot of white churches, arson, whatever it was. I was wondering if you were in a situation where you were asked to contribute to a church that was burnt down, could you? And it could become particularly problematic if, let's say, you're in a small town. And remember, some of these churches, evangelical churches, are big supporters of Israel. And I know, by the way, that Rav Asher Weiss holds that there are certain things you can do to keep these people, you know, pro-Israel, etc. But let's say you're in a community, a small community, you have a synagogue and a church is burnt down. And then they come to you as the rabbi, will you contribute? And if you don't, there's questions of Ava, you can create enmity. And if the synagogue would have burnt down, they definitely would help you. I'll tell you a story about what happened when I lived in Boston about this soon. But then you have the question, of course, Christianity is Avodah Zarah. How can a Jew support giving money to a house of Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah meaning foreign worship. As I think I said already, Avodah Zarah should be translated as foreign worship, not idolatry, although most Avodah Zarahs are idolatry. All idolatry is Avodah Zarah, but not all Avodah Zarah is idolatry. Christianity is not idolatry. They don't worship idols, but it is Avodah Zarah. Now, the question that's going to have to be dealt with by Rav Misas is the notion of Shituf. Those who are interested in further of what I'm saying, in the latest Chakira, there's an article by the late Rabbi Asher Turin on this very topic of the role of Christianity in halacha and the ruling of Rav Moshe Isserles. Rav Moshe Isserles is going to give the important ruling I'll speak about in a minute, the Ramah. Who's more important than him, especially for Ashkenazi? Rav Asher Turin was a rabbi in Toronto. The people here from Toronto knew him well. Big Tom Chacham. His brother actually was a rabbi in Scranton at the yeshiva. But I knew him only because I was honored every time I came to Toronto. He would come to hear me speak. He was he had this project he was working on, and they published it in the Chakira. There is a passage in the Tosafot that mentions that there's no prohibition in bringing a non-Jew to be meshatef, to join together God and something else, another being. The question is how you understand that. Rav Moshe Isserles understands this to mean that non-Jews are, as long as they believe in God, there's no problem with them associating another being with God, Jesus, whatever. We Jews are obligated to have an absolutely pure belief in God. However, non-Jews are not obligated, as long as they believe in in God, if they associate other beings with God, like they do believe in God, they just associate Jesus with God, that is kosher, permissible for non-Jews. It's not permissible for Jews. So there's a distinction here. Now, this is a huge dispute among the Achronim. Is this the proper way to interpret the Tosafot? Jacob Katz even weighs in us in his book, and he says there's no question that the Ramah is wrong. And all Tosos was talking about, it wasn't giving theology. He simply was saying that there's no prohibition, you causing him to swear, but make an oath by bringing in other things to God. But that doesn't mean that it's permissible for them to have a theology believing in this. This is how you know to be Yehuda. But nevertheless, the Ramah is the Ramah. And if you look in many places, they all say, B'nai Noach, Einam Muzarim al Shituf. That non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. So it's a huge machlokas. David Berger believes that Yaakov Katz is correct, that Tosafot never intended that Christianity is a permissible religion for non-Jews. So I asked him this publicly at a talk. Even though he believes that, what does he think about, would he think that it's then inconsistent, if I believe the same thing, to rely on Ramosha Israelis? Who says no, that this is what the Tosafot means, if I think he's wrong. And he did not think it was inconsistent, because at the end of the day, we can think all we want, but the Ramah has Paskin Halacha, and if we want to rely on the Ramah, we can rely on the Ramah. That's different than if, let's say, the Ramah had the facts wrong, if, let's say, he had a faulty manuscript. And other people might disagree. They might say, well, if you're convinced that Tosafot doesn't mean that, you shouldn't rely on the Ramah. In any event, the question, I went to Rav Masas. And in my question, I pointed out to him, this was actually a debate in Germany in the 19th century and early 20th century. There was a great rabbi. I'll show you his picture now. I think he looks like a rabbi, but he was. His name was Rav Mordechai Horovitz. Oh, you're on? No, hold on. No, where am I? Can't find anything. Here he is. This is Rav Mordechai, in England, in Germany, they call him Marcus, Mordechai Horovitz. He was the Rav of Frankfurt, of the general community, not the Hirshian community. I said he had a little bit of a long hair. And he's the author of the Sefer, Matei Levi. Two volumes, Shelos and Tshuvos, his Talmud Muvak of Israel, Hilda Simon. And he discusses it in his Sefer. And he says that the question he was asked was, about again, a town, a small town. Catholics asked, they were building a synagogue and building a church. And they asked the Jews in Germany, could they help contribute? And the Matei Levi has a long tshuva in which he goes through the whole thing and making the case that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. So this is a permissible religion for non-Jews. So then he says, he concludes, he says, Pashu that Slainu Shein Kan Shum Mr. Kal, that he said, we all assume that for Christians, their form of worship, for non-Jews, Christianity is a permissible form of worship. And therefore, you can, there's no problem contributing. And he says, Shemitzvah Nami Ika, there's also a mitzvah, Mishum Kiddush Hashem. And he mentions that Moses Montefiore helped when they were building a church in Ramsgate in England. He also contributed some money, and he thinks that's a big Kiddush Hashem. On the other hand, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, who held that non-Jews are obligated in Shituf, not obligated. So he also agreed that Christianity is a permissible religion for non-Jews. When I say it's a permissible religion, it means that therefore you wouldn't need to try to convince someone who is interested in giving up Christianity, whatever. I don't know how you explain it. It's not idolatry. It's nothing. It's just a form of a permissible religion. Rav David Zvi Hoffman still held that for Jews, since it's forbidden, we cannot give any money to them. The third figure who dealt with it was Rav Yitzhak Unna. He was the Rav in Mannheim later, before World War II. And he supports the Matei Levi. And he calls attention to the fact that, I'm holding his tshuva right here, that the Mishnah speaks about in Gittin that during the sabbatical year, you can't help a non-Jew physically, you know, work the fields. But the Gemara says you can machzik bedvarim. That is, you can encourage them. You can tell them good job. You can explain to them how to best do the fields. And Rav Una, he responds as Sholin Vidorshin. He says, well, there's obviously no difference also in giving them tools. If you can speak to them, you can also give them tools. You just can't be involved with them digging or planting or anything like that. So he says it's the same thing. If it's a permissible religion for the Christians, just like we can give the guy tools to work in the sabbatical year, so too we can give them money to build their church, because it's permissible for them, just like it's permissible for them to work in the sabbatical in the fields. He says it's the exact parable. So I sent these tshuvot to Rabbi Misas. I sent it to him. I also sent it to Rehuda Ratzel Henkin. We'll see his answer as well, because Rav Misas was in Morocco. He had lived among the non-Jews. The problem today is that many poskim living in Israel, they've never lived among non-Jews. They don't know what it means to live in an environment. And you have some crazy rulings and things that have come out of places like Jerusalem, B'nai Brak, simply because the idea of Tarchei Shalom, just simple, for Mishum Eva, even quite leaving apart more, maybe you'd say more advanced considerations, they just don't... You know, we've had a lot of great things with the state of Israel, great achievements, but we've had some bad things. And one of the bad things is a reversion to an extreme sort of fundamentalism and hatred of the other, which we never had, simply for pure utilitarian reasons. You never could have had this in Europe. It's no accident that all the poskim in Europe concluded that non-Jews are not bound in Shituf, etc. What am I referring to? Well, you had people from these groups, these extreme, the Kav type of people who I mentioned, who would routinely, I don't know if they still do, but for years, spit at priests in the old city when they passed them. I mean, such a thing would never have been imaginable. Obviously, they'd kill you in Eastern Europe, but still, the idea that you would act this way. So, and stuff that's said about the Pope and all stuff that, so there's been a really a reversion to very unhealthy attitudes. But if a post-like Rav Misas, who lived among the non-Jews, who understands that Pesach also has to take into account wider considerations, I thought he would have a good insight. And you'll see when he was attacked for this Pesach. This Pesach became a little famous, actually. And you'll see how he was attacked, how he responds. He doesn't respond like a rabbi born and bred in Israel. He responds like a rabbi who knows what it's like to live among non-Jews. But before we get to that, so let me just, so he goes through the various sources. He quote he agrees with the Mate Levi. He says that the Mate Levi has proven barayot atzumot. That non-Jews are not obligated in this associationism, which refers to Christianity. And on page Samachet in the book, if you have it, he again explains, even though Jews, he's quoting actually the Maharam, who says that Jews are obligated in Shituf, but there's no prohibition in causing a non-Jew to be Meshatef. That argument, which I mentioned about, there's no Ifnei Iver. Again, the same thing, the Ben Noach, Shehainu Akum, Eino Muzar El Shituf. And then he continues to explain that he explains why he quotes the Sholim V'Dorshin and Ravuna. It's like giving them help during the sabbatical year. And then he concludes, page 90, 69, Diminido Didan Muta Bashofi. He says it's obvious that it's permitted that you can give them money, you can contribute to help build their synagogues. And then he brings another proof that today, really, they're not. Even if you're going to say they are of the Avodah Zarah, they're really not today anymore, because there's this argument that they really don't know what they're doing. They're just on Minhag Avoteihem. And then he concludes, Uvifrat, D'yesh Mishum Chilul Hashem. He says, if you don't, we're talking about a situation where you're asked to. And actually, it wasn't only if you're asked to, well, what did I say? My exact language was, a situation where the reform and the conservative are donating. You're in a situation like a small town, not necessarily even a small town, where the reform and the conservative are donating, and you, the Orthodox synagogue, if you don't give, let's say they asked you for the money, it's going to create a chilul Hashem, a big chilul Hashem. Also, there's the question, as I said, of enmity, not to mention the fact I said that some of these churches are big supporters of Israel. And then he says there's chilul Hashem, there's Eva. He says this is a Tosefet Heter, that it just adds to the Heter. That's his ruling. Halacha l'maisa. So I don't need to tell you that in an atmosphere like Eretz Yisrael. And he published this in the Torah Journal or Torah. For someone to read something like this is just shocking, that you're going to get. You can even have a Havamina to help. So he was attacked. by this in the journal Or Torah. And if you look in his Sefer, Shemesh U'Magen, this tshuva is published volume 3, Siman Lamed. In Siman Lamed Aleph, he has his response to this rabbi who attacked him. And in his response, he says, he repeats a number of things he says, but this is interesting. The second to last paragraphs, he says, the person who attacked me, who was shocked even to hear what I says, Sarich hitragel l'dat sheyesh chasidus li'et mishpat. He should know that there's chasidus and then there's law. And he says that we cannot hide the mishpat, you know, because it's going to make people think it's strange. He says, Sarich ha'agid et devar ha'mishpat. U'mishir otzulik chaseid, en mi yomar lo matase. If you want to be a pious, a chasid, fine. But the question is, what's the halacha? Aval ikar hu ha'mishpat. U'vifrat kasher hu inyan shel tzibur. He says, especially in the cases we spoke about, it could create enmity. And then he says, and he continues, and he, yeah, so that basically he, I think he has one more thing I want to read you here. The point is, you get that the people, you know, in Israel, these yeshiva people, they don't understand that sometimes, you know, there's eva, there's considerations of enmity and other things, and it's a different ruling. So I find that very interesting. I also sent the question to Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin. We know Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin. We've spoken about him before. He should live and be well. Let me show you his picture again. I didn't know if they were going. Either one was going to reply, so I sent it to, and I, had they both came back with different answers, I don't know what would have been. I wasn't asking really Lamaisa, I'm not in that situation, but you'll see something Rabbi Henkin says, which is Lamaisa. And Rabbi Henkin, he disagrees with, it's a long tshuva. It originally appeared in his B'nai Vonim, volume 336, number, and he disagrees with some aspects from the Masas, because I sent him Rabbi Masas's tshuva as well. In addition to the tshuva, he says something really interesting on page 78. He says that he's speaking about, you know, how we relate to non-Jews, and he makes a parallel. He says that in the destruction of the Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple, even though it was bad, there also was something good that came out of it, chesed, because he says that if the Beit HaMikdash would have existed a few hundred years subsequent to that, and the non-Jews would have abandoned sacrifices in their worship, which they did when they adopted Christianity, then the Jews would have learned from them, and they would have said, wait a second, sacrifices are not an advanced form of worship. And they would have looked and started feeling contemptuous of the temple. So he says it's actually a chesed that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed when it was, because then people wouldn't have turned against Karbanos. Now they're all theoretical, but there wouldn't have, people never would have accepted a situation of Karbanos, and they would have turned against Judaism at all. He's saying the point is that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed at the right time, because then we developed the spiritual Judaism. And when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, the third Beis HaMikdash will have a whole new psychology, a whole new way of relating to it. But he's saying it had to have been destroyed then, because otherwise we wouldn't have developed properly, because the people would have rejected Judaism because of the sacrifices. I find that really interesting and perhaps radical. But he goes on and he speaks, similarly, he finds reasons to permit also giving money for a church, let's say, that was burnt. He doesn't see a problem. He says that you can, especially, they can build it without your money. You can donate it, and you can say that it's for, let's say, the parking lot in your mind or things like that. And again, his tshuva is driven even more than Rav Masas by questions of Eva, that you could be in a situation where it's difficult to get out of it. And then he ends, at the end, he says something which really is lamaisa for all of us. He says that you can intend the money you're giving to build the, let's say, the shiur team or the piping or the parking, whatever's not related to the heichal, because he holds it's avodah zarah. Rav Henkin holds it's avodah zarah, but he still finds a way, because you're not building the church per se, you're building the other things. Rav Henkin holds it. Rav Masas holds it's not avodah zarah. And then he says, based on my argument, he says you can also donate to reform synagogues and conservative synagogues. He says when it's a situation of eva, when it's a situation of enmity. I think, I'm not sure, I think he's including the conservative reform synagogues donating also when it's Ava. He's comparing them exactly to the church. So what would be a question of Ava? You can imagine cases like this. When I lived in Boston, the Young Israel Brooklyn was burnt out. And you had all, it was really interesting because everyone started contributing to, there were things in the Boston Globe, local non-Jews, children from various schools were sending in money to rebuild it. So then what would happen the next week if the church burnt down? We'd be in a problem because we'd have to give them. I also found it interesting, the Jewish Advocate, I remember, was covering the local Hebrew schools, the Reform and the Conservative. They made a big deal of the synagogue burning down. The local Hebrew schools were sending in letters and money. And I said to one of the rabbis, Dafka, not in Brooklyn, one of the other towns in the area, Newton, I said to him, isn't this a bit of a problem that we're accepting all their money? Because if their synagogue burnt down, the students at our yeshivas, Maimonides and whatever, obviously the Haredi yeshiva, they wouldn't be sending money to the conservative and reform synagogues to help them rebuild. So isn't this a bit dishonest on our part that we're accepting the money and they're making a big deal about it, how everyone was sending in money? Well, the rabbi said to me that he doesn't think so because others can understand that you can support a certain charity even though you recognize that they're not going to reciprocate. We can all appreciate when I was young, Lakewood Yeshiva would come to my town and have a breakfast every year. Now all the people would go and they'd give money, but no one expected that the people from Lakewood are going to give money to our institution. So you can, we can understand that. I can imagine a case, like let's say you're in a town, you have an Orthodox Jew and a Reform Jew, a conservative, and it's burnt down, let's say by Nazis, something like that. And then they want to rebuild it. It would be very hard for the Orthodox not to have some involvement with it. And here Rabbi Henkin says in a time of Ava, you could. Now, this is not just theoretical, though. I mentioned some of the crazies in Israel who, it's one of the bad things that has come out in recent years. Well, these people, a group of them burnt down, or one of them, I don't know how many, a few of them, they burnt down this church in the Galilee, an important church. We can't have a situation where churches are being burnt down in the state of Israel. The anti-Semitism this would cause, it's unimaginable to be in a situation like that. But these close-minded, simple people in Israel, maybe some of them don't think like this. And therefore, Rav Nachum Ravinovich, there he is right there, he ruled, and he's a right-winger, he was a right-winger, a big right-winger, that in this situation, when Jews, it's one thing if the church burnt down by itself, what does that do with us? But if a Jew burns down a church, we have to give the money to help build it back. And he also, Rabbi Rabinovich, the shita is that Christians are not, it's not avodah zarah for Christians, etc. It would be a more of a problem, let's say it really was avodah zarah, let's say a real avodah zarah temple and a Jew burnt it down. Mishum Eva, maybe you could as well. Rabbi Rabinovich was attacked by people saying, you're avodah zarah and everything. You know something? And no one who lives in Chutz Haaretz would ever say that this is a crazy thing. The spectacle. Can you imagine if Jews would burn down churches, what that could lead to? We're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for far-fetched cases that they might not rescue us. So you should know that this isn't just a theoretical thing. It was halacha l'maisa under the aegis of Rav Nachum Rabinovich in that case. And now let me end by showing you something that, where is it here? So Rabbi, look, I don't want to speak about open orthodoxy or anything. This has nothing to do with open orthodoxy, but Rabbi Dov Linzer, and you could totally disagree with what he said. I'll show you what he said based upon what we just read. What happened was, remember when the attack in Charleston? So Rabbi Linzer wrote this letter, an open letter, that after the terrible attack in Charleston, the burning of churches, he encouraged people to show support as a way of Kiddush Hashem to donate to the churches, to rebuild the churches. And you know what? You can make a case. It's irrelevant. It's not the same thing. We weren't involved. Whatever. I don't want to get involved in the debate. What's interesting, though, is that they attacked him for this, and He says that he explained that it's not a vota zara. He actually calls this a widely accepted ruling, despite the fact that poskim disagree. I don't understand that sentence. Rabbi Linzer says that it's a widely accepted ruling. It's actually the ruling of the Ramah, but that it's not a vota zara. So they reply that poskim disagree. Of course, poskim disagree, but poskim agree. And so then they quote Rabbi Linzer's letter, and then they attack him. And but you know, you can attack Rabbi Linzer all you want for things, but in this case, it's not his ruling. If you read his letter, he is citing Rav Masas. He doesn't even cite Rabbi Yehuda Tzlankin. He's really citing Rav Masas as the justification for this. So it's a little dishonest and disingenuous to attack him like this without dealing with the tshuvas he's relying on. So now he thanks me for giving him this tshuvot. I didn't give it to him because of this. He was giving a class once I saw online on Jewish views of Christianity. So I thought he'd find it interesting. So I sent in the tshuvot before my book appeared, of Rav Masas and Rav Una and Rav David C. Hoffman. So then he incorporates it in his talk, and this responds him of Rav the Mate Levi that permits with the church donating to a church. This was actually cited by Rabbi Lamb when the Cardinals came to YU, and he was attacked for this. He cited the Mate Levi. Strange thing, perhaps, because the Mate Levi isn't speaking about inviting cardinals in. It's a completely different situation. But Rabbi Lamb was trying to give us as an example of things that we assume on the face of it have to be wrong, like having a cardinal in a inside a base medrash. Maybe it's not wrong. And he said the Mate Levi dealt with a case, obviously, who could ever imagine giving money for a church? Look what they did to the Jews all these years. And yet the Mate Levi, a posek mufak, he ruled it was permissible. So that Adkan Simon Lamed Ches. For Lamed Ches 39, we return to this Gadol. I think he's a Gadol. I mean, he's a great, great posek. Where is he? My picture, Rav Ratzabi. I told you last week, politically, some of his ideas I don't like, but for the Yemenites, he's really a great, great posek, and his Sfarim are quite interesting. Three volumes of Olat Yitzchak. He published a number of volumes of Rav Yitzchak Salich's work, all sorts of stuff. Of the things I learned from him, Yemen, I'll give you an example. some of you are going to like this. Because I use this with a rabbi. There's a rabbi was, I was there, and the rabbi was arguing against yoetzets, and that you shouldn't have them. It's, you know, any woman who feels embarrassed to go to a rabbi, you know, it's the problem is with her. And I said to him that, you know, he thinks it's all a feminist thing. In Yemen, they never would take questions like this to the rabbi. Ratzabi writes that in Yemen they had such snius that only women would decide these questions. So they had yoetzets in Yemen. And you can't accuse women in Yemen 200 years ago of being feminists. This was just their natural sense of modesty. You actually need to overcome your natural modesty to do the other thing. So he was making it seem like it's only a feminist thing. But Ratzabi speaks about how never in Yemen they wouldn't dream of doing this. And by the way, later I learned such as Yemen, in Tunisia, Morocco, in the Sephardic world, they never would show what they call maros to rabbis. It's an Ashkenazic thing. So all sorts of interesting things I've learned about Yemen from. So I asked him a question. Why did I ask him this question? It's nothing to do with Yemen. Some of the questions I asked him dealt with more, you know, issues that he was focused on. But I think he's, as I said, from reading his Sfarim, I think he's a posek mufak. And I'd like to be part of this republic of letters, of asking questions of what I mean by a posek mufak. When I write some of these questions, I'm not asking halacha l'maisa. I could ask lots of people. They can give me a yes or no answer. I write to people, and this is another people who ask me, why do I write to people? I write to people who I think are able to think clearly halachically and formulate your tshuva in a way that I feel will be authentic and take into account the sources. And I want to interact with certain people. I never had any interest in writing a letter to someone who's going to send back a one-word answer, like Rav Chaim Kanievsky. What I am interested in is people who actually will interact with what I send them, like Rav Masas. I sent them all the tshuvas of Rav Una and Matei Levi and Rav Yosef Hoffman. So I want to have a give and take and a discussion and a scholarly interaction. That's what the Republic of Letters was all about. And from his tshuvot, I saw that Rav Ratzavi was perfect for that. So the question I asked him was as follows. The title of it is, can you mention the name of Oto Ha'ish, of Jesus, and also the day of their holidays? And why did I raise the question? And first of all, there's a volume of responsa called Divrei Chachamim, which has questions and answers, and none of them from Rabbi Sheinberg. And it says in that, you shouldn't say, you shouldn't mention the name Jesus. You shouldn't call him by his name. If you've grown up in the Jewish world, you know he's often called Yashka or other things like that. And then they said, so that's, you shouldn't, that's the Chumrah. But then they said, there's no problem in saying the word Christmas, because that's not his name, just the name of the holiday. So I actually thought, who the fuck cared? It should be the opposite. First of all, Jesus is mentioned in the Gemara. Jesus is mentioned by the Rambam. So what could be the problem with mentioning Jesus' name? And as for Christmas, I said to Rav Ratzadi, although everyone does say it, it seems to me it should be forbidden. Because the Vilna Gaon says explicitly, you can refer to Jesus by his name. But he says that... the word he says that he quotes the Rav Yah, others say this, that the Isser is of Allahus and Adnus. That is, you can't refer to an idolatrous thing if the name has refers to its divinity or its rulership. Well, the name, what is Christmas? It means the Mass of Christ. Christ means Messiah. Mishi Christos means anointed. So it doesn't mean God or anything, but still, by referring to Jesus as the Messiah, we are giving him a status of rulership. And therefore, I thought that Dafka should be the opposite. No problem saying Jesus, but you shouldn't say Christmas. And some people don't. They say Croxmas or things like that, but Xmas. But here it says that you're allowed to. So I wrote to Rav Ratzhabi. He begins by saying, you know, I don't know anything about, you know, the Christianity, these things from Yemen, he shouldn't. He agrees that, yes, you can say that, you can say the name. And he doesn't think Rav Sheinberg says it's a halachic problem, just it's not appropriate to say the name of Jesus. But then he gets into my question. And this tshuva, incidentally, is mentioned by Rabbi Willig. Someone emailed me that on one of his shiurim, he deals with this very tshuva of the, and he knows who it's written to because he did it from the Ola Yitzhak, not my book. And he doesn't really like this answer so much of Rav Ratzabi. He says, no, there's no problem saying Christmas. He says, because this isn't the name of their holiday. All you're saying is, you're saying Mashiach. So fine, he's not Mashiach, but he said, no, it's the name of the holiday, he says, doesn't, she'ein shmo shel yom ha'dam atzmo omer shu Mashiach. He's saying the name of the holiday doesn't say that he's Mashiach. It's not like you're saying the name of the holiday is Jesus is Mashiach. The name of the holiday is just Mashiach, Christmas. And he says that wouldn't apply, but I don't know. That's very strange. And Rabbi Willig also agreed it's very strange. Now look, the minhag is to say Christmas if you want to, but it just appeared to me that no one ever pointed out, you'd think that someone would have argued what I just argued, that the word Christmas, Christ, implies, well, it doesn't imply, it's saying, when you say Christ, you're not just saying Messiah, when you say Christ, you're referring to that Christ, the Jesus. And therefore it would seem, at least I thought it would seem, and had he come back and said it's usher, I might have stopped saying it if I didn't need to. But he rules it's mutter, which is Rav Sheinberg, so it doesn't matter what I think, it's what they think. I wrote a whole article, you can hear it online, on Torah in Motion, the practice of not studying Torah Christmas Eve. And then, the last words, he says, see, responds of Mishnah Halachot, volume 9, number 69. So if you open up the Mishnah Halacha, this is really interesting. Volume 9, number 69. He raised a different question. He was asked, can you, if you're sending a letter to someone and they live on a street, and the street is named, or the city is named of one of their, refers to Jesus, let's say. When I was in Oxford, you know, one of the colleges there is Jesus College. So could you send also Christ Church, can you send a letter to a street which has that name on it? He says that in Buenos Aires, for example, there's a street called Jesus Street. So, and he explains that it's not a problem. And he tries to, he wants to distinguish between also speaking. He says, certainly there's no issue in writing. What's interesting, and I want to raise your attention to, is that he says in the middle here something, and also when you mention this, you're not accepting upon themselves as a god or anything like that. But on the first page of it, he says, nevertheless, there were people who were doctic, and he gives some examples. He says that tzans, the Hasidus tzans, he says, in the language of the nations, Lashon Akum, that's the vernacular, is the name of Avodah Zarah, and they change it from sons to tzans. This, as far as I know, is incorrect. I looked a lot today. I'm fine. He's thinking sons refers to saint. It doesn't. It's as far as I could tell in the Polish where it comes from. But then he says, and the Sheva Kihivot also. He says there were cities named after idolatry, and we Jews called them something else. He's actually mistaken here. There weren't cities. There was a city. The Sheva Kihilot. Let me get you the Sheva Kihilot here. The Sheva Kihilot are as follows. You can see it here. Eisenstadt, Kobersdorf, Lankenbach, Mattersdorf. These were in Austria, certain Sheva. They were one community. We go there on my Central Europe trips. Israel Hildesheimer opened up the first modern yeshiva there. Deutschkreuz and Frauenkirchen. And Kitzen. Those are the seven kihilot. And they all were led by one chief rabbi. The Panim Meirot was the most famous. Now this city, Deutschkreuz, that's the only one, not Frauenkirchen. In Yiddish, in Hebrew, Frauenkirchen is Frauenkirchen. It means woman's church. But Deutschkreuz, German cross. Deutschkreuz is actually, in Hebrew, it's known as, you see this here? Tselem. Instead of cross. If you thought when you heard about the Rabbi Greenwald, he used to put Ashkacha on Kedem wine, if you remember, the Rav of Tselem. If you look on an atlas, you'll never find the city Tselem. Tselem doesn't exist. Tselem is just the word that Jews used because they didn't want to use the word Kreutz, cross. So they called it Tselem. We have some other examples of this. Setner. There's a legend. It's not true that a lot of people think that Satmar means St. Mary. It doesn't mean St. Mary, it means great village. But a lot of people think Satmar means St. Mary. And even in Europe, there was a practice where they wouldn't write Satmar. They would write, here you see it written in German, but they'd write Satmar. Believe it or not, the Satmar Rebbe, who usually writes Satmar, sometimes he writes Satmar. So there were people who would write Satmar. Nevertheless, there are times when they didn't do that. This is a good one. Kalvaria. Kalvaria is one of the most important Lithuanian towns. Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael were rabbanim in Kalvaria. Sometimes you see it in English, they write Kalvira, but that's wrong, it's Kalvaria. Kalvaria, that's Calvary. There's really strong Christian associations there. No one thought of changing the name. However, St. Petersburg, in Jewish sources, is usually written as Petersburg. So I was thinking, after I saw this, that, wait a second, what about, here it is, Calvaria, which, the town is named because it was established in the 7th century as a shrine commemorating the crucifixion of Jesus, but that's what they called it. But then I was wondering, what about Jewish San Francisco and all these places? I discovered something today. Well, I shouldn't say I discovered it today. The first thing I discovered a long time ago, the second thing I discovered today, the first thing is my children, My daughter and son-in-law lived in San Francisco for about a year and a half. Baruch Hashem, they left that place. If you think you New Yorkers, that New York is bad, what's going on, you should live in San Francisco. They were in downtown. I had to walk. I did not even go back to shul for Mincha Ma'ariv on Shabbos afternoon. It was in the Tenderloin district. And I literally felt like I put my life into my hands and the stuff that's going on in that city. But whatever. So when I went there, I wanted to look for the shuls. And I remember when I went to the page of San Francisco, although here it says Chabad of San Francisco, if you look everywhere on the website, they don't say San Francisco. They won't say San. It's S Franciscans, all over S Francisco. And at the time, I thought it was weird, and I didn't really think much of it, and I thought maybe it's some shtick. But just today, when I was thinking of what I was going to say, I said, well, let me check this out. So then I went on other websites of Chabad. San Jose, there's no San Jose. You read the whole thing. It's S Jose. And it's all about San Diego. They won't say San Diego. It's S Diego. And the different, these are all from San Diego. This is also San Diego. They won't say San. Where is it? San Antonio also. It's S Antonio. I am certain of this, that there is a plan in Chabad, an intentional thing. They won't say San. The only one I found of all the Chabads, here, look, Santa, say Yaakov, you're in Florida. Did you ever pay attention to this? They won't say Santa Barbara. It's S. Barbara. All over, all when they talk about it, it's Chabad and S. Barbara. The one difference I found, though, Santa Fe, for some reason, Chabad and Santa Fe doesn't have a problem. All over the website, they're referred to as Santa Fe. But there's no Santa Barbara. It's S. Barbara, S. Francisco, S. Jose. I have no doubt if anyone knows about Chabad, I am certain. It can't be a coincidence. It has to be. This is whoever heard it from San Francisco calls himself S. Francisco. It must be this issue that they feel that, and that's not even an idolatry, it's a saint. The word saint, well, it's not an idolatry, but that's what they have. Okay, I see we've gone, we've reached the end today. Let me just, to get you, whet your appetite. It's next week we're going to get into one more issue dealing with Jews and non-Jews about the question of wearing these clerical garbs that they used to wear in Germany, which come from the Christians. Is that permissible? Also, we'll hear from Rav Chaim Rappaport, fascinating question about, which I raised to him, and how much money do you need to spend to save someone's life? Ashtus, as we say in Yeshiva, you should spend everything to save someone's life. Human life is worth, so what? So if I come to you and I tell you now that if you give me everything you have, all of your money, including your house, so you'll have to live in public housing, but you could save a life? Are you obligated to? And if not, why not? Don't we think that a life is worth more than everything? And we'll move on from there. So I hope you found the tshuvot of interest. Let me take some of the questions here. My learned group here, very learned people. Okay, someone texted me about the Meiri with Christians. The Meiri. Well, the Meiri doesn't really look at it the same way Shituf. The Meiri simply holds, the way I understand the Meiri is at least, that theology is irrelevant. It's if they accept the belief in a higher power, we're not concerned with what exactly they do. And theologically, it could be Avodah Zarah in a technical sense, but when Chazal spoke about Ovdei Avodah Zarah, they spoke about people who were evil, who weren't Gedurim B'Darchei Hadatot. So that's at least that's how Halbert Hall understands it. So it's very different. People like Rudovitz Hoffman are saying that, and others, Rav Cook, this is the standard view in modern times in the modern Orthodox world, and not just the modern Orthodox, that non-Jews are not obligated in Shituf. Rav Cook also held this. David Eisen, incidentally, David, someone knows you from they were in, I think he said he was in the army with you. I'll text you later. He heard me mention you. He's listening on tape. You say, adjacent to my house in Beit Shemesh is the Franciscan monastery, Beit Shemal, who was named after Rav Gamliel, according to Christian tradition. A number of years ago, vandals spray painted very important texts on the outer wall of the monastery. I participated with the local running group. on Friday morning, where we ran to the monastery and assisted the monks to whitewash and remove the inappropriate graffiti. Frankly, we were motivated by the tremendous chilul Hashem performed under our noses and did not think about any halachic issues raised by helping the monastery and did not ask any shaylos. Okay, you're right. I mean, that's your initial reaction. But after the fact, of course, then people want to look at the halacha. And for rabbis, you know, you're expressing what Rav Kook might call the intuitive Jewish soul that just does the right thing. But still, you know, halacha also then has to come in and look, because you were doing like canine poking, though. You might just do the immediate reaction, but then you need to examine it. Although I will say that sometimes people could be turned off by this halachocentrism. Eliezer Berkowitz tells the following story, which maybe, David, you will appreciate. Eliezer Berkowitz, he writes this in one of his books, that he spoke at one of the women's seminaries. Think of the women's seminaries, you know, one of those, doesn't say which one. And he was speaking about the Holocaust, and he mentioned how a story that of a woman that was with her child, and when they came to Auschwitz, they put the child one way to the gas chamber and the mother to live. And the mother refused to be separated from the child. And the mother went holding the child, because what mother would leave their child to go die, and went to her death together with the child. And he told the whole story and spoke about, you know, what he saw, the value of this. But he said that the students had a new reaction. So he said, he describes this whole thing. You have to see the passage. He asked the Rebbe, the rabbi, the teacher, what's going on? Why didn't the girls have any response to this? And the rabbi replied, they were thinking about, I guess maybe spoke to them later, the rabbi, they were thinking about what the woman did. Was it halachically proper? Or was she a suicide by going with the child? And then Berkowitz screams, in his book, he goes, what kind of Torah are they teaching at this school? That they're going to be asking, was the woman committing suicide when she went because she couldn't bear to see her child, you know, go to the gas chamber by herself. So, did Parisian Jews contribute to the reconstruction of Notre Dame? I haven't heard. I don't know. When it burnt, some people said it serves them right, because that's right by there was where the debate over the Talmud was. It's there was a Jew who contributed a lot of money, but as a group, Jews were not put in a place where they had to. There's no expectation. However, Rav Henkin and Rav Masas are speaking about where there's sort of like an expectation, and by you not doing it, in theory, it could be a situation. That's why the chief rabbis of England would go and still go to church events, church weddings of the royal family, funerals, because they feel in their position from them not going, it would create problems. So Rabbi Lookstein, he went to the inauguration in the church of Obama. He said, well, I'm doing sort of the same thing. And the response was, well, he's not an official spokesman for the Jewish community. And it wouldn't have created the same issues. Naftali says, Rav Mordechai Levi Horowitz is the son-in-law of the Aruch HaNer. Rav Huna was the son-in-law of Marcus Horowitz. Correct. Although the Aruch HaNer died before he was the son-in-law. He did. And Rav Huna was the son-in-law of Marcus Horowitz. The Aruch HaNer, we had classes on him, a Rav of Altona. Naftali, I believe you're from the Washington Heights community. So Rav Mordechai Horowitz was the Rav of the Grossgemeinde, the larger community of Frankfurt, not the Frankfurt separatist community. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was very angry at the Matei Levi. He refused to give him any kavod, refused to be in the same room with him. And his successor, Rabbi Breuer, also refused to be together with him, because they did not consider Mordechai Horowitz an authentic Rav, because he was the Rav of the community, the larger community. But he went with the heter of and the encouragement of Rav Israel Hildesheimer, his Rebbe. Yes, Jay Yellen, it's not surprising Rav Windsor was attacked and not a sorcerer. Sifkin was the exact same position. Yeah, it's not surprising. I just think it's interesting that in this case, you can attack people, him included, attack me, attack anyone you want for things they say. But in this case, he really was just applying the earlier decisions. So if you think those decisions are crazy, that's also fine. But at least try to explain why Rav Masas is wrong, why the Matei Levi is wrong. It wasn't fair. David says, is only the name of Oto Ish problematic, namely Jesus? What about